Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a couple of subjects in the news, begin in a moment, and speak with Sidney Blumenthal, who was a former senior advisor to President Bill Clinton. He's the author of the best-selling book, The Clinton Wars, which is now available in paperback. And Sidney Blumenthal is also a regular columnist for The Guardian of London and Salon.com, and we're talking to him about his recent column, Faith versus Reason, an examination of the Kerry-Bush presidential debate. We'll be talking to him about that in a moment, and we'll also speak with Ambassador Joseph Wilson, who was the last United States ambassador to Iraq, and he effectively turned out the lights in the U.S. embassy at the beginning of Desert Storm, and of course he was also the last American official to meet with Saddam Hussein prior to the 1990 Gulf War, and he wrote an opinion piece in the New York Times that the White House retaliated against as he exploded the truth and logic of President Bush's claim in his State of the Union address, suggesting that Saddam Hussein was trying to purchase uranium from Niger. And this led to his wife, who was a CIA operations officer, being punished for Ambassador Wilson's truth-telling. And we'll be talking to him about the irony that CBS 60 Minutes spiked a story about the forged documents that were used to justify this idea that Saddam Hussein was purchasing uranium from Niger. And, of course, the show that CBS replaced the Niger story with, to some extent, relied upon forged documents, although the documents in question have never been proven to be forged, but their provenance is in doubt. So I'll be talking to Ambassador Wilson about that and other matters, particularly about Iraq, since he was, as I mentioned, the last diplomat to turn out the lights in the U.S. Embassy in 1990 in Baghdad. And we'll also speak with Leon Smith, who's the publisher and editor-in-chief of the Lone Star Iconoclast, a weekly newspaper based in George Bush's hometown of Crawford, Texas. His recent editorial endorsing John Kerry, entitled John Kerry Will Restore American Dignity, is not just notable because the paper is based in Crawford. It's also keenly insightful by any standard. Sidney Blumenthal, what was your impression of the debates? Obviously, let me just sort of suggest to you that in terms of alpha males, I don't think there was much doubt about who dominated.
Well, Lieutenant Kerry dominated Lieutenant Bush in this debate. In a sense, Kerry showed up, and Bush, I don't know if he was AWOL, I think the real Bush showed up. So my impression is really, in part, I have many impressions of the debate, but I have also impressions of the impressions. One of the ironic reactions to the debate was that the, for the most part, conservative commentators were willing to say that Kerry had won outright and that Bush had done poorly. And yet the mainstream journalists in the Washington Press Corps, at least in the first 48 hours, would not say that Kerry had won, although every single spot poll and subsequent poll and all the conservatives said Kerry had won, which shows to a degree how craven they've become and that they're so intimidated they don't even know when they can follow the right wing.
So in other words, they're so afraid of being labeled as being liberal that they're incapable of even being objective?
Well, they retreat into a false objectivity that leads to you know, them proclaiming that they're objective, whereas in fact they're hiding the facts. It's a kind of, you know, absurd logic that's led them there.
Well, I think that the point that you just made is that maybe this was the real George Bush that we saw. This is the most closeted, the most cloistered, the most protected, the most insulated, the most secretive president that I've ever seen in you know, I can't go back more than a few decades, but still, this, to me, is who this man is. This is who has been running this country all this time. And it was one of those rare occasions when he was alone. He wasn't protected. He didn't have Karl Rove at his side. And he was almost petulant and peeved that he had to be there in the first place.
Well, I think that Bush was offended that he had to hear a contrary view from John Kerry. I don't believe that he hears many contrary views, which partly explains the catastrophe of U.S. policy. You've got to hear your hard cases and worst-case scenarios presented to you by your assistants, and it doesn't seem as though that's something that appears very possible in front of President Bush. He operates from an extremely closed and small circle of advisors. He has said famously he doesn't read newspapers, but instead relies upon what his advisors tell him. He doesn't reach out beyond them. The information flow to him is extremely narrow. It appears that he doesn't read it all or pay much attention to some of it, even when the headline on it is Bin Laden determined to strike inside the United States. The famous memo of August 6, 2001, which he has said publicly and Condi Rice has underlined, was a historic document and did not necessarily have any information that should spur them to action, and they did nothing between then and September 11th. And now he's running on September 11th, but he's hiding who he is. This is a secretive administration, secret in its councils, the Cheney Energy Task Force, secret in the way in which decision-making takes place. What is Cheney's influence, in fact? Who makes the decisions? We know from the 9/11 Commission that Cheney made the decision without consulting the commander-in-chief, gave an order to the United States Air Force to shoot down commercial airliners flying on 9/11, and then lied about it to the 9/11 Commission. It's all in there. So now we see on the stage, unprotected, unfiltered, the real George Bush. It's not that he had a bad day. This is who he is.
Well, apropos your analysis here, let me just quote you in your article, "Faith versus Reason." That's in the Guardian as well as Salon?
Yes.
And just quoting you here, "Skepticism, pragmatism, and empiricism are Bush's enemies. Absolute faith prevails over open-ended reason, subjectivity over fact. Those who do not pray at his altar of certainty are betrayers of the faith, not to mention the troops. Belief in belief is the ultimate sacrament of his political legitimacy." So there you go.
Yeah, that's what I've written.
We can go home now.
Strongly and intensely about something, and it can be heartfelt, but it doesn't mean it's right. Bush, in fact, made the case for absolute certainty in this debate. It was extraordinary. And as Kerry pointed out, you know, you can be certain and you can be wrong. But Bush would not concede that point. He couldn't. When he was asked by Jim Lehrer what the miscalculation had been involving Iraq, that Bush himself had said, he used the word miscalculation. Bush said the miscalculation was that he didn't expect the United States Army to succeed so quickly in capturing Baghdad. Well, A, that's false. It's a lie. And B, it's also a lie that they didn't know what would happen afterwards, because the State Department produced 17 volumes of a project called The Future of Iraq, which predicted precisely what would happen and offered options and policies on how to prevent it and what to do positively, that was not only ignored but dismissed and suppressed by the White House and the Department of Defense. This Future Iraq project was produced by the State Department. Colin Powell and all of his people were shut out because they didn't believe in the rosy scenario that Bush had for Iraq. And the miscalculation was not of all of his administration. It was not of the State Department. And Bush knows that. And if he doesn't know it, if he doesn't know it and he's telling the truth to the American people, it's more dangerous than you think.
Well, even on this program prior to the war, I had a handful of the specialists who speak Arabic and know Iraq, people like Graham Fuller, Yusuf Ibrahim, and others. They all unanimously predicted exactly the outcome. It'd be a quick victory followed by a slow defeat. The only caveat now is that it's a quick victory followed by a quick defeat. And how much is George Bush responsible, in effect, for this collective denial that seems to be throughout this country? The press, after all, were the cheerleaders, at least a large part of them, were to get us into this war. They didn't distinguish between being reporters and patriots. I keep wondering when reality will get some traction here. We have clearly lost this war. It is getting worse. I think by the time whichever candidate is inaugurated, it will be probably lost. So who's really to blame for this kind of collective ignorance about the reality of what George W. Bush has got us into?
Well, in part, this election is a contest between fantasy or even delusion and reality. And desire to grapple with reality. Those are really the two parties now, the fantasy party and the reality party. Bush believed before the war, and he stated so in a famous speech before the conservative think tank American Enterprise Institute, what would happen after the war? We would be greeted as liberators. Iraq would instantly be transformed into a democracy. It was widely assumed Ahmed Shalabi, the Iranian double agent and disinformation artist, would become the leader of Iraq, the neocon favorite. And the region would be transformed. We would be in a forward position against Iran and Syria, possibly toppling those regimes. And the Palestinians would suddenly become convinced to give up the Intifada and turn quiescent. None of that has come to pass. The exact opposite, in fact, is true. Bush refuses, whenever confronted about whether or not he's made a mistake or a miscalculation, to bear the responsibilities for the consequences of his actions. The press bears an enormous responsibility for this. I was enlightened to see the New York Times run on the front page today, which everyone ought to read, a very long piece about how the administration, the Bush administration, knew that its case that Saddam was building nuclear weapons was phony. It's a very long investigative piece in the New York Times. This material, by the way, has been known for easily more than a year. The Carnegie Endowment issued a report on this long, long time ago, and Hans Blix has mentioned this, the head of the UN weapons inspectors, and so on. Nonetheless, it's good to see it in the front page of the New York Times. They have a lot to answer for, given the disinformation that they poured out from Shalabi and other agents of influence in the run-up to the war, which was crucial in the orchestration of falsehoods that helped create the war. So the press bears enormous responsibility, as well as responsibility for constantly presenting a false image of George W. Bush that Karl Rove could not ask more from.
And Sidney Blumenthal, what's happened vis-a-vis Kerry? Because Kerry did, after all, vote for the authorization, and he's been haunted by that vote ever since. And he seems to, for the longest time, have left on the table the very issue that George Bush is most vulnerable on, which is this this war that we've already lost, that he's got this country into, this national humiliation that just gets worse by the day. How did he navigate his way out of this? And what do you think happened there? Because it seemed for the longest time he just simply wasn't able to talk about the one issue that he could beat up Bush with.
Well, Kerry's gone through a political evolution in his explanation of his war vote and his position on the Iraq war. By mid-August, he had hit rock bottom, simply defending his vote on the war authorization in the tersest way. He was not He was misrepresented. The quotes were taken out of context. But, you know, you ought to understand in politics that's the game the other side's going to play, because that's what they do and that's who they are. He got himself in a deep hole, and once he recognized that, he began a series of speeches about Iraq and what's wrong there. These are very serious, long, detailed speeches with counter plans. And, you know, his position is not an easy position, because Bush has created a catastrophe, and we have to live with it.
So in other words, why should John Kerry accept Bush's defeat?
Well, because if you're president,
right,
you have to deal with it, and you are going to have to. You can't roll back time and get in a time machine and go back to the point where there was no war. We're now in Iraq, and it's a major crisis for U.S. security and national interest. And the question is, how do you deal with it now? It's from here that you have to develop policy, not from an imaginary point as though all of the events that have unfolded can be brushed aside.
Now, is there any coincidence here that some of your old colleagues from the Clinton administration have joined this campaign somewhat late, and that there's been a lot of criticism of Bob Shrum prior to this? Is there a coincidence here in Kerry suddenly taking off and getting focus and taking charge and creating his own narrative instead of having them create their negative narrative of him?
Well, I have a lot of respect for people who put themselves in the arena and subject themselves to the kind of criticisms that you get when you're there. I did it myself and was, and, you know, that's the price you have to be willing to pay. But I think there's been way too much focus on political process stories. The real story here is that John Kerry made a decision. Supposedly, Kerry couldn't make a decision, but he made a very hard decision in the middle of his campaign, reframed it. He's the one who made the turn. And that's why the campaign is where it is today. It was Kerry's decisiveness that did it.
Well, others could argue that he, you know, he had to reinvent himself back in Iowa and fire one campaign head, bring on another one, and effectively doing the same thing, and that people would say, well, does this indicate a man that is a good administrator or therefore make a good president?
Well, I don't know. You know, politics has ups and downs. My old boss, Bill Clinton, got himself in a few scrapes and would get himself out of them. Was he a good president? Absolutely. The conflict and being able to be flexible and recast your course is not a sign of weakness. I believe that adaptability in dealing with very difficult, often ambivalent, well, it's ambiguous reality is a sign of strength, and that's what we face today. And these events are tests, and we see Bush being rigid, stubborn, refusing to adapt, and we see Kerry evolving. And I think one is a weakness and one is a strength.
And just in closing, Sidney Blumenfeld, how do you see the next, well, we've got Tuesday, you've got the vice presidential debate.
We get to see the acting president debate.
By the way, I apparently, you know how these debates have been constipated anesthetized by lawyers to the point where democracy is hardly served, although I must say the fact that the networks ran a split screen was a rather inventive way to get around these strictures, and I think it served the public enormously. But I understand that one of the restrictions that Dick Cheney's insisted upon in the vice presidential debate is that they cannot stand at lecterns, that Edwards can't be mobile like a trial lawyer addressing the jury, that they have to be seated behind desks.
Mm-hmm.
Is that...
Well, you know, however this works, we saw in the first debate that it was a debate. And people do have ways of revealing themselves. you know, we'll see Cheney's scowl for a very long time. His impassivity and his sort of secrecy, his the way in which he creates an exterior to hide his true actions. And then we'll see Edwards and whether or not he can penetrate that veneer and rise to the occasion and show himself to be a substantial figure. So I think that's a very interesting debate. And then we have two more contests between Kerry and Bush. These are crucial for both men. I think there have been, you know, the debates are absolutely perhaps even decisive events in this campaign.
Well, apparently the first one has been, at least in terms of reversing the polls, where Newsweek's now putting Kerry ahead.
Well, my view is that in world politics, there is nothing more gladiatorial than presidential debates, and it comes down to the two men alone in the arena. There's nothing like it in world politics.
Well, so you're looking forward to the next couple of weeks then?
You know, we will see if Bush can adjust himself and whether he can control himself, and whether or not Kerry can also continue making his adjustments as he turns his boat towards Bush. So I think that the audiences for these debates are going to be huge, and the size of the audience is itself a political factor.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Sidney Blumenthal.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Sidney Blumenthal, who's a former senior advisor to President Bill Clinton. He's the author of the best-selling book, The Clinton Wars, which is now available in paperback. He's also a regular columnist for The Guardian of London and Salon.com on the web. Let's now turn to the second subject and speak with Ambassador Joseph Wilson. I'm speaking with Ambassador Joseph Wilson, who served in the diplomatic corps from 1976 to 1998. He was ambassador to Iraq under the first President George Herbert Walker Bush, and was the last American official to meet with Saddam Hussein prior to Desert Storm in 1990. Ambassador Wilson is the author of the best-selling book, The Politics of Truth, Inside the Lies That Led to War and Betrayed My Wife's CIA Identity, A Diplomat's Memoir. And Ambassador Wilson, just this week or so ago, the CBS ran a story that got them into trouble. It was based on documents which many people consider were forged, although that's not necessarily been proven. Certainly the provenance of the documents is in question. But in order to run that story, they spiked a story which they spent a lot of time working on, which I believe you appeared in or filmed for, that really got into the issue of the background and history of the documents that President Bush referred to in his State of the Union address, that suggested that Saddam Hussein had tried to acquire uranium from Niger. And these documents are apparently forgeries, and the CBS piece that we unfortunately aren't able to see dealt with this. You were interviewed for the piece, were you not?
Yes, I was. I was asked about my trip to Niger and about what I had found and what I had not found. A number of other analysts, I understand, were also interviewed, including the Iraqi head of the nuclear program, as well as a State Department official.
And I believe they also interviewed the Italian woman who received these documents, and Elizabeth Berber, an Italian journalist who passed them on to the United States Embassy in Rome.
That's my understanding. I don't know exactly what all made the final cut for the program, but I understand they interviewed the Italian go-between who provided her with the documents as well, although that may not have been in the interview. Rocco Martino was his name.
Rocco Martino, and he apparently has, they've established links to SISMI, the Italian intelligence service.
That's my understanding from what I've read also.
And that the documents were first published in a Berlusconi newspaper, and the implication being, of course, that is where they came from. Although in the State of the Union address that got President Bush into trouble, he referred to the documents coming from British intelligence.
Well, he didn't really refer to documents. What he did is he just said the British intelligence has learned that Saddam Hussein has attempted to purchase significant quantities of uranium from Africa.
Mm-hmm.
The British will maintain that they did not know about the documents or that they were forgeries at the time they made that claim. But they had, it was essentially the same intelligence. At least that's what we must conclude, since they have produced no other significant evidence that would justify making that assertion.
And you wrote an opinion piece once this the questions about the president's statement in the State of the Union address surfaced. You wrote a piece that appeared in the New York Times to set the record straight that you were in fact sent to by the government to Niger to look into this issue, and your conclusions were that it was bogus, and that. Op-ed piece led to retaliation from the White House, where your wife, who worked for the Central Intelligence Agency, was outed, as they say, and her career has basically been destroyed. And therein lies another story where a special prosecutor, although he's not referred to as a special prosecutor, has been looking into it. What's the status of that investigation now? Because I understand that a number of the reporters that were given this information by whoever it was that the prosecutor is trying to find, where does it stand vis-a-vis testimony from the reporters?
Well, there are a number of reporters who have, in fact, been deposed or have testified. Matthew Cooper of Time Magazine, Walter Pincus of The Washington Post, based upon their sources having signed waivers saying that the protection of sources arrangement should not pertain in this particular matter. There are a couple of New York Times reporters who have not testified. And that is now being litigated, and it's all a question of whether or not reporters have an absolute right to protect the identity of their sources. My own view on this is that the press is way too defensive on this. I think that they will lose the case if it goes to the Supreme Court. There's a well-established precedent dating back to 1971 that says they don't have the right to protect sources when a crime has been committed. My view is that the issue is not essentially a First Amendment issue. It is, by and large, a question of whether or not the president's staff is going to obey his order to fully cooperate with the Justice Department. They haven't done so far, which is why we haven't been able to get to the bottom of this. And if I were the press, that is the focus that I would be taking. That's the area where I would be exploring, is why are the president's staff not obeying him? Is this willful? Does the president not have real command and control over his troops, or what gives here?
Well, this is of course an election year, and we're closing in now in the last few weeks of the campaign. I guess so. It's looking less and less likely that there's going to be any resolution until after the election.
Well, that depends. If the special counsel is working to a investigatory timeline, then the external politics should not weigh in his decision on when to issue indictments, if he's going to issue indictments, or when to bring this to close. If, in fact, there are political motivations for either withholding the indictments or on the part of the White House officials not testifying, then that really is a travesty, and that is justice being ill-served. This, after all, was a violation of the national security of the country, not the only one, I might add. Since my wife's identity was compromised, there have been, coming from the most senior reaches of the White House, leaks as to the name of a double agent that we had turned for Al-Qaeda, a fellow by the name of Khan Noor, a communications specialist. It's been disclosed that the Iranians were told by Mr. Shalaby through an American that we had broken their codes, and anybody who's a student of World War II knows how important it was to Winston Churchill's effort to have been able to read the German mails who had broken their codes. And then, of course, there's an ongoing investigation into some senior Pentagon officials having perhaps given secrets to other foreign powers.
Well, there is the litany that you have just outlined. There is a common thread throughout most of what you're talking about, and that is the finger is pointing at the so-called neoconservatives, this group of people that are in the deputy secretary level at the Department of Defense, and who are the architects of the Iraq War. And so, am I correct in identifying a thread there with all of the? I mean, at least the Chalabi and the alleged Israeli spying.
Well, I think that's right. While each of these are discrete and separate actions. One senior government official told a reporter by the name of Warren Strobel that this is the whole piece of the pie. This is the whole thing. In other words, that the same group of people have essentially been involved in each one of these violations of the national security of the country.
And what do you expect to happen here? Because I mean, I've often said over the months and years as this Iraq war has turned into this massive national humiliation that the United States is suffering, even though it seems that it's starting to catch up, the reality starting to catch up. The phrase I've been using is that when is reality going to get some traction here? It seems in the last few weeks that both the press and, to some extent, the candidate Kerry have started to talk about the way things really are. Do you believe that that finally the American people are starting to wake up to the true nature of what we've got ourselves into in Iraq?
Well, I think the debate the other night was a real turning point. The president was clearly disoriented. He was clearly out of touch. With the subject at hand. It is just simply not enough to go to war and then to explain to the American people, well, this is hard work. I see it on television. I think that it was a terribly disappointing and, frankly, frightening display by the president. On the other hand, I think Senator Kerry was cogent. He was concise. And I think that the differences between an approach that that exercises American leadership, and leadership being defined as having followers, versus this unilateral, I don't need nobody's permission to go to war, that particular difference is stark, made all the starker by the events on the ground. Whatever one may think of the war, it's hard at this stage, 18 months after Saddam Hussein was deposed, to argue that the people of Fallujah and the people of Samarra, whom we are attacking now from the air and inflicting great casualties, were somehow involved in any aggressive actions against Americans prior to our having launched this war.
But I think it's becoming apparent, isn't it, Ambassador Wilson, that the United States has committed its sort of national credibility as a global leader in this war, and it may be based upon some fundamental false assumptions. One, that we are fighting to make a country which, and the people may not want it to be a country, and our boys and girls are sacrificing their lives for delivering freedom to people who may not want freedom. At least it's beginning to look that way.
Well, wars of liberation are always the most costly in terms of political capital. And they become frightfully expensive as soon as the liberated population appears to be ungrateful. And that certainly seems to be the case now. Irrespective of whether the Iraqis want to be one country or not, and I happen to think, in my experience from having been over there right in the aftermath of the Iran-Iraq War, was that there was a highly tuned sense of national identity. That is being frayed right now. But irrespective of what the outcome is, the fact is that forever the United States will be blamed for that outcome. And in a place like Iraq, where they remember the fall of the Baghdad Caliphate as if it were yesterday, when it was in fact in 1258, forever is indeed a long time.
And, of course, there was the British experience in the 20s, which has, unfortunately, a lot of echoes of the present. But the real situation, as far as I can tell there, is that nobody can go out of outdoors now. The press are even hunkering down and afraid to leave because of kidnapping. And there's only 140,000 American soldiers. There are 2.5 million Shia inside Sadr City that appear to be in either a state of revolt or bordering on that. And then you've got these Sunni pockets in the so-called triangle, which seem to be operating with a combination of former Baathists and even al-Qaeda. I mean, that seems to be the most frightening thing of all, is that more and more reports you learn is that the presence of al-Qaeda in that country is growing. And that was, of course, the assumption for going in there was that there was a link between Saddam and al-Qaeda, which has been disproven. But now, ironically, al-Qaeda appears to be in Iraq.
Well, my understanding from everything I've read is that, in fact, there are relatively few foreign fighters inside Iraq, that by and large this is all homegrown, and that by and large every day that we're seen to be killing Iraqi civilians, we are actually adding to the number of people who are sympathetic and super supporters of a resistance operation against the United States, what we call an insurgency. I was struck last week when the acting president of Iraq likened what we were doing to violations, to essentially war crimes of attacking civilian populations, and likened it to what the Israelis are doing in the, to the Palestinians. I don't think that bodes very well when the leader of the country we've just liberated is accusing us of doing what the Arabs' worst enemy is accused of doing in the Palestinian territory. So I think that that particular linkage of us to Israel does not bode well for us, our role as liberators and the providers of freedom and democracy to the country.
But the Shia themselves always refer to their enemies inside Iraq as the Wahhabis. So there must be, and I understand that there have been lots of videotape confessions that have been found in Saudi Arabia from these young men who are crossing over and providing the suicide bomb.
Well, I have no doubt that there's some there. I just don't think that is what that's not what drives the resistance. What drives the resistance is what always drives the resistance. It's trying to defeat the occupation of your country. Now, interestingly, the Shia, for all the restiveness that one sees in Sadr City and the efforts of Muqtada al-Sadr to muster his militia a couple times in the last 6 months, despite that, the Shia have been largely rather passive in this. When they come off the sidelines, and I suspect it will be at any time, then we really do possibly have a significant problem on our hands. Because as you point out, there's 2.5 million of them just in Sadr City and Baghdad alone, not to mention throughout the south. We have great difficulty securing even the road from the city of Baghdad to the airport, which is only about 25 miles. We have convoys frequently attacked on the supply line going to Jordan. If the Shia decide that they're going to take some political actions or engage in the resistance, they will find fertile territory in the supply lines going south to Kuwait.
But that's what seems to where it seems to be heading, without being alarmist or unduly pessimistic. It seems that it's likely to reach a critical mass where we may find ourselves in a situation we're in Saigon in April of 1975.
Well, I think that's right, except that I think we probably have more firepower, but I think it's entirely possible we will have to fight our way out of there if the Shia do decide that any postponement of elections in January is unacceptable. And I suspect what they will do is, rather than engage in this guerrilla-type warfare, they will likely just put on massive demonstrations challenging American soldiers to shoot protesters who are armed with little more than rocks. That's certainly what they did in Tehran when they overthrew the Shah. That's what they've done a couple of times already in Iraq, in Baghdad, and in the south.
And this all could happen before the inauguration of the next president.
Oh, certainly, sure. What is happening now in Iraq, of course, is that it is cooled off so that there are people can spend more time outside during the day, and the days are shorter. So for the Sunni who operate best at night, planning their bombs and setting up their explosives and setting up their ambushes, they have more time during the night to do it. And for a demonstration strategy, it's now cool enough to actually go and demonstrate during the day. So all this and may really come together rather rapidly, particularly if, as Kofi Annan has said, it may not be possible to hold elections in January.
Well, finally, Ambassador, it seems to me that this war was lost a couple of days after it was won, on April the 10th, after the statue of Saddam was toppled, and then a couple of days later the looting began. And my analysis is that the Iraqi people were never given the assurance from the American conquerors, as it were, that the bad guys were going to go away. They just simply didn't prepare and plan, and didn't have the ability to assure the public that the bad guys were going to go away, and that the United States was there to help them, in effect, by not providing security. And it seems from the beginning, when the looting started and the gangsters started to take over the streets, that's when we lost it.
Well, I think that's right. I've argued all along, based on my experience as part of the military command staff when we did the Bosnia operation, that in the aftermath of the invasion, the very first thing that needed to be done was to reassure the 90% of the population that just wanted to get on with their lives. And the way to do that was to restore basic services, not to 80% of pre-war levels, but to 200% of pre-war levels. Make the Iraqis the best medicated, the best cooled, the best fed Arabs in the region, essentially. And the second thing, of course, was to ensure public safety so that citizens could go about their business without fear of being pillaged, raped, murdered, carjacked, and all the other things we've seen happen on the streets of Baghdad. And every day that we were unable to do that, unable to leave Iraqis with the impression that their future would be better than their present or their past, was a day in which a certain percentage of the population became disaffected and began to side with the insurgents or the resistors against the occupiers. And we became known as occupiers rather than as liberators. That's where we stand now.
How could this have happened? I mean, it's astounding to think of the $200 billion effort, not to mention the over 1,000 deaths and the countless wounded, much greater than, I believe, the numbers that we're told. How could this have happened?
Well, I think blind faith. I think this reliance on a theory that had no grounding in history, geography, culture, or even sound international relations, this dependence upon a few pets like Ahmed Chalabi, and this sort of delusional thinking that somehow just by going in there with our M1 tanks and our Abrams fighting vehicles that we would indeed be greeted as liberators, and then suddenly it would be like the Portuguese Revolution in 1974, they would move from dictatorship to elections and democracy. As a Western power in the 70s did. By and large, I think we deluded ourselves in doing this. It was, I guess, the best quote on this. It was a strategic error of historic consequences, and that came actually from a Reagan Secretary of the Navy. I wish I could end on a more positive note.
Well, I think the point that you can't keep stressing enough is that we're dealing with reality here, and that I think both the press and our government have not served us in presenting the reality of what's going on in Iraq.
I think there was a suspension of critical faculties that the neoconservative movement just drove a truck through. While the press was going around saying we're Americans first and journalists second, Don Rumsfeld was running around saying we have to hit targets in Iraq because there are not enough targets for us to hit in Afghanistan. It's as simple as that. I was struck by the president's performance in the debate. It reminded me of Alfred Lord Tennyson's poem, The Charge of the Light Brigade. Into the Valley of Death rode the 600.
Well, I thank you again for joining us.
Thank you, sir.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye now.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. So just speaking then with Ambassador Joseph Wilson, who was the United States Ambassador in Iraq at the end under the first President Bush, George Herbert Walker Bush, and he was the last American official to meet with Saddam Hussein prior to Desert Storm in 1990. He's also the author of The Politics of Truth, Inside the Lies That Led to War and Betrayed My Wife's CIA Identity, A Diplomat's Memoir. I'm now speaking with Leon Smith, who is the publisher and editor-in-chief of The Lone Star Iconoclast, a weekly newspaper based in George Bush's hometown of Crawford, Texas. His recent editorial endorsing John Kerry, entitled John Kerry Will Restore American Dignity, is not just notable because the paper is based in Crawford. It's also keenly insightful by any standards. And you are in a part of the world, Leon Smith, where the majority of the people love George Bush. I'm in a part of the world where the majority of the people loathed George Bush. How are you lonelier in the Lone Star State since you wrote this?
Not really. I've had numerous telephone calls from people and emails sent to me from actually all over the world that are in agreement with the editorial that we ran. There are some people around our part of the country that are fairly upset with me, and I guess that's understandable. But we felt like it was something we really needed to do. We were hoping that our readers would look at the issues that are going to be long-standing, you know, for a long period of time, like Social Security, stem cell research, things that are going to take us years and years into the future, and try to apply the candidates to those issues. You know, you can talk about the war, you can talk about certain issues that are going to be short-term. And it's really hard to get a real good feel of, you know, as far as the war goes, I think probably Bush or Kerry can handle that part just fine. I think, you know, they rise to the occasion. The directions of the two may be different, and I really prefer Kerry's direction. But the long-term issues are the ones that we really try to focus on.
Well, because being on the liberal side of politics, I find myself mostly at gatherings where you're preaching to the converted. And you often wish that people on the political left in this country had the ability or the interest to reach out to the center and come up with a better mousetrap. And I guess you being in Texas, which is a much more conservative state, you have more practice or understanding of how to reach out to conservatives. Why is it that that there's not more ammunition like the ammunition that you've written in your editorial?
Well, that I don't know. The what I'm finding is that I think there are two Republican parties. There's one that's radical and one that's really mainstream, close to the middle. And it's that mainstream that's close to the middle that actually is closer to Kerry's way of thinking, I believe. And that's, you know, that's odd to say, but that's what I'm finding in emails I'm receiving. I'm receiving a lot of support emails on what we did from Republicans. They want the Republican Party back to where it was, not where it is now.
Well, you know, I after the debate the other night, I watched the spin machines going and the punditry, and it was truly just disgusting. I really had to turn it off. And the only place where you can get any unfiltered information is C-SPAN, where they let people call in on either a Republican or a Democrat line. Mm-hmm. And the thing that was striking about everybody that called in on the Republican line that supported George W. Bush and his performance or his lack of performance, they were all born-again Christians, and they said, we support him because of prayer and because of God. So Is that the identifiable constituency down there in Texas?
I think it is to a certain extent. I'm a little bit dismayed that the religious right has portrayed conservatives in a certain way, that if you don't fit into that capsule, you're not a conservative. My preference is to go back to Webster and define liberal and conservative that way. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're conservative, you're for the status quo. If, for instance, if you have money in the bank, as the United States does, and that's conservative to keep it there, it's liberal to waste it and spend it. So that would make George Bush a liberal.
Yeah, but the impression you get from those that support him from the faith-based religious community is that it's almost a theocratic impulse. It's because of his religiosity, not because of his ability to govern.
Yeah, that's a shame. You know, you don't hire somebody based on that. This is a hiring process. You know, we're going to be hiring somebody to run the country. And that's one angle we took in the editorial. We wanted to stack the two candidates up to the major longstanding issues and take the position that we're not, you know, electing a king or an emperor. We're hiring somebody to do the job. Is there work ethic there? Is their approach going to be there to these issues? And, you know, it came out that Kerry was the winner.
Let me again remind the audience, if I may, I'm speaking with Leon Smith, who's the publisher and editor-in-chief of the Lone Star Iconoclast, a weekly newspaper based in George Bush's hometown of Crawford, Texas, and his recent editorial endorsing John Kerry, entitled "John Kerry Will Restore American Dignity," is available. I got it at iconoclast/texas.com. Is that the best way to download it?
I would go www.iconoclast-texas.com.
Uh-huh.
That is our website. We'll be putting a new site up on Tuesday, late Tuesday morning, and we will be running an editorial talking about this past week that we've been through, so if anybody wants to read it. Also, we're hoping to post most of the letters and emails we've received. We've received about, I think, 700 as of today, and that's a lot for us.
Well, what's happened, though, in terms of, you say that you've gone through a stormy week. Have you had any advertisers punish you by pulling revenue?
Oh, yes. We've had, I think, about 10 advertisers in Crawford pull out. I've had some in Clifton pull out. We have a newspaper also in Clifton. And, you know, there is a very strong Republican, you know, party group here. And we've had several advertisers pull their advertising. We've lost several subscriptions, but we've had several people that agree with us and what we did that are trying to help us make up the difference in our revenue so we can keep operating, and that's, you know, that's nice.
And what about your subscriber-in-chief, the President of the United States, who happened to be in Crawford preparing for the debates the day that your editorial came out?
That was coincidence. We were planning on doing the editorial on that date, not knowing, you know, what his schedule was.
Uh-huh.
And it just happened to happen that way.
And any feedback as to whether the president read the editorial or reacted to it?
He hasn't reacted to it that I'm aware of, and I don't know if he's read it or not. I'm sure that members of his staff have, at least I would think so. But we haven't really heard anything from him directly.
So if you're I'm just trying to get a sense of how representative you are there in Texas, which is you know, a holy, they call it Bush country, and
right.
You know, it used to be run by Democrats largely, and now more and more you've got, you know, a handpicked governor, you've got two senators essentially were handpicked by Bush, You had the spectacle of the legislature being outfoxed by Tom DeLay and having to retreat to Oklahoma. So where does it stand being a Democrat in the Lone Star State?
Well, I think the Democrats are in a minority. The two senators, Kay Bailey Hutchison has been a senator for.
Well, that's right. I meant she's been around for a while, but
she's good. She really is.
Right, but the Cornyn is very much a Bush clone, isn't he?
In my opinion, he is.
Right, and Rick Perry, the governor, is pretty much a Bush clone as well.
Very much.
Right.
I'd like to see our state controller, Carol Keaton Strayhorn, run for governor. I mean, she tells the truth. I think she's right on with you know, mainstream Democrat and Republican thought. I mean, she's good, and I wish she would run for governor. She would be great.
And who's running against Kay Bailey Hutchison?
She's the controller right now. And of course, she hasn't said she's going to run for governor, but she would be good if she did.
But you do have one Senate in play, don't you? One Senate seat?
We have, two Senate seats? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I thought you had one in play that was being on this November ballot.
That I'm not aware of. I'm not sure about that.
So there's nobody running for the United States Senate in Texas?
Not this time.
Uh-huh.
I think they rotate about every 6 years or something.
Right. But the House delegation has been drastically cut down, hasn't it, by Tom DeLay?
Oh, yes. They did the redistricting plan. It passed. That's why some of the Democrats left the state for a while. They were trying to fight redistricting.
Huh.
And I think they were really wrong in pursuing redistricting. We had some meetings, throughout the state, and people turned out in droves not wanting the state redistricted. But they were able to force it through anyway, which left me just really irritated because I attended those. And I spoke in favor of not redistricting. But, we're stuck with it, so we have to deal with it.
Well, is Tom DeLay vulnerable, though? I understand that he is being challenged.
He is, and I think he's very vulnerable. I think people are getting very upset at the fact that, he's bulldogging his way through with plans and ideas that don't match what most Texans think is correct.
Right, and some of his associates and he's been censured just last week by the Ethics Committee. And
yeah, I think there's going to be a lot more to that, too.
Right, and then there's the fundraising scandal that he's associated with.
We're doing an investigation ourselves into that.
You are?
Yeah, the Iconoclast has done several investigations. We do investigations about four or five times a year. We're very small staff. But we're trying to, do some things that have impact. We investigated the tax test, which, students are required to take,
uh-huh.
and the vulnerabilities of it and the fairness of it. We looked into the employment agency, unemployment taxes.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a major discrepancy in the way that's being handled. We did a story on that several months ago.
The LA Times did a story on how, one of Bush's platforms is tort reform, and how he basically has left Texas citizens without many recourses in the courts. If you have a contractor that rips you off, you're out of luck.
You're out of luck. And if you remember during his acceptance speech, he really, really badmouthed lawyers.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of resent that. Lawyers are very important, but he really got on the case of lawyers, and they're an important part of our fiber, and they really need to be able to do their jobs and represent individuals, individual by individual, on cases, and not have caps put on and things that would, basically free insurance companies to not worry about what they do. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, we'll see a lawyer debating a Dick Cheney on Tuesday. So
That'll be interesting.
I thank you for joining us,
well,
Leon Smith, and keep up the good work there in the Lone Star State.
I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. Just speaking then with Leon Smith, who's a publisher and editor-in-chief of the Lone Star Iconoclast, the weekly newspaper based in George Bush's hometown of Crawford, Texas. And they just recently endorsed John Kerry for president, and there's been a certain amount of backlash to that. I'm Ian Masters. I thank Mark Maxwell, the engineer, Louis Vandenberg, the producer, Carol Coote, and Grant Gruber, the assistant producers.